What's the flywheel mechanism that makes it possible for entrepreneurship to drive the market process? It's the matching of intrepid lenders in intrepid lending arrangements with the intrepid entrepreneurs who can lead us all into the future, even though they may be a bit crazy.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. This week we're talking to John Tamney, a great student of and cheerleader for entrepreneurship. Some of you may be aware that he's been engaged in a friendly debate with the Mises Institute about the effects of Federal Reserve activity recently. But I wanted to talk to him about entrepreneurship. John makes entrepreneurship understandable and vivid to the popular consciousness by his anecdotes about LeBron James and individual specialization and the impact of a Taylor Swift concert on pricing for transportation that can provide personalized immediacy when traditional forms of transport become scarce. Today, we'll discuss the intensity of American entrepreneurship, how the best ideas get matched to the best capital, the leadership role of entrepreneurs, and how entrepreneurial specialization represents the end of work. John also helps us focus on what's interesting and what's useful about economics. In fact, best of all from John is his focus on happy. The happy results of entrepreneurship for everyone in society. It's so easy to complain, as we should, of course, about government intervention, regulation, and destructive spending. But if we cultivate entrepreneurship and generate multiple Steve Jobs and Phil Knights, we'll generate a lot of happiness, betterment, and growth, and we'll innovate around the politicians. John, of course, is editor of Real Clear Markets, vice president at FreedomWorks, and a senior economic advisor to Toreador Research and Trading. His new book is titled They're Both Wrong, A Policy Guide for America's Frustrated Independent Thinkers. Other books by John include The End of Work, about the exciting growth of jobs more and more of us love, Who Needs the Fed, and Popular Economics. John, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hey, Hunter, thanks for having me on.
You make economics relevant and interesting, and you've been doing it for a long time. You've written lots of articles, several books. You have a very distinctive style, and so we're going to talk about economics today and maybe get your help in making it palatable to people.
I make it relevant and interesting simply because it is. I think it was Mises in Liberalism, his brilliant book, who made exactly that argument, that he said it's not a dismal science, it's a beautiful study of people, and he put it much better than I did. I've never understood why economists have this need to turn into charts and graphs what is so easily described by the world around us. It's as though they're striving to make something unintelligible. So that they can avoid revealing how little they understand.
Well, you termed the phrase, or you titled one of your books "Popular Economics," and that talked about LeBron James and Downton Abbey, and I think Taylor Swift, and you also mentioned Hollywood movies and Michigan State football while quoting Mises at the same time. So you found a way to do that. Talk about popular economics. How did you come by that title?
I think my initial title was Economics is Easy. It's the one time in the history of my writing career, at least of books, that the publisher, I thought, came up with a better title. At one point, they had Water Cooler Economics, and I said, you've got to be kidding me. So they finally happened on Popular Economics, which I kind of liked. Again, my view is that economics is first grade material, that the only people who really don't understand economics are economists who try to make confusing what is easy to understand, what can be explained by athletes and TV shows and movies and famous people. I don't get their use of charts and graphs. And so in many ways, popular economics in all of my books are a subtle middle finger to an economics profession that's made boring what's endlessly interesting.
But you chose to keep the term economics. I was talking to a marketing guru this morning about marketing Austrian economics, and he said, there's no place for the word Austrian and no place for the word economics, which was a bit discouraging. But do you think you've been able to make progress towards a popular realization of the benefits of thinking economically?
I'd be lying if I thought I'd made huge inroads. Clearly, I haven't, as evidenced by the way so many people continue to see things. I long ago said it was going to be my life's work to just discredit the laughable notion that economic growth causes inflation. Yet to pick up a Wall Street Journal or a New York Times or an Economist magazine or anything, you constantly see pundits and economists say, well, you know, if the economy gets moving too fast, it's going to cause inflation. And so clearly there's a lot of work left to be done, but it's very heartening to come across people, and I do with great regularity, people who say, you know, your books changed how I view the world, how I saw it. You made clear what had been opaque. And so that's really an uplifting thing.
Yep. I was reading the Wall Street Journal this morning. I just came across a little phrase at the end of a sentence that said, an economist warned. And it struck me that that's what economists do. They're always negative and warning, and it's going to be bad.
Yep, isn't that true? They're always looking for some awful scenario. And if we do this, this, and this, we'll get to this. What frustrates me is they're never right. It's okay, so it's easy to pick on the Fed. The Fed employs more economists than any other entity, but they've always been incorrect. And of course they have been. And let's add that when I was at Goldman Sachs, I mean, the economists were notoriously incorrect, that the clients of the firm it was a profitable endeavor for them to just bet against whatever the Goldman economists thought was going to happen, just take the opposite position. And it really is shooting fish in a barrel. An economist thinks something. Okay, so some individual thinks he or she can model the infinite decisions taking place every second among hundreds of millions and billions of people around the world. Of course they're wrong. What fascinates me is that any people ever took them seriously to begin with. The pretense is just remarkable.
Yeah, in fact, the whole premise is wrong, that the goal is to predict. And we understand from our view of economics that you can't predict. The future's uncertain and it emerges. You can't predict the future.
That's right. We just know that freedom works, that free people with barriers to their productivity removed from them tend to do very well. That's not to say that there aren't some extraordinarily productive people who do very well with more barriers put in front of them. Look at New York and California, two heavily regulated, heavily taxed states, yet it's got the most innovative, brilliant people on earth populating both. And so, but generally speaking, if you remove barriers, you get more productivity, and this shouldn't be a mystery. Yet economists continue to try to model human behavior, which is just an obnoxious waste of time.
So we try to go through that other door, John, the individual door, specifically entrepreneurship. And you know, academically, that's called microeconomics, but I don't think it's a useful differentiation. But you said in one of your books, an economy is just a collection of individuals. And you also talked about an intense entrepreneurialism that defines the American economy. So paint that picture for us of American entrepreneurialism. I hear you linking individualism and entrepreneurship, and that's a system.
Oh, what a great question. Okay, so let's start with the economy is just individuals. The person who most vivified that for me was Henry Hazlitt. I think the most important sentence ever written in any economics book ever written was Hazlitt's in Economics in One Lesson. He wrote, quote, "What is harmful or disastrous to an individual must be equally harmful or disastrous to the collection of individuals that make up a nation," end quote. And so what was Hazlitt saying? It was so brilliant. Of course, probably most people glossed over it. That's not a knock. But Hazlitt was saying the economy is not some living, breathing blob that you can touch. It's just a collection of individuals. And when you break the economy down to the individual, you can then see why economic growth is so blindingly simple. You can also see why you'll never lose an argument, an economics argument ever again, because I don't care what someone's ideology is. On an individual level, you can't say an individual has improved economically if he's taxed more. No individual has improved economically if he spends more time complying with regulations rather than creating something. No individual is improved by money that's constantly being devalued by the U.S. Treasury. No individual is improved if talented people from around the world are barred from serving its needs solely because they live in another country and they put up tariffs on these other people. And so when you break the economy down to the individual, everything becomes clear. Okay, what improves the individual improves the economy. At which point, why are Americans so entrepreneurially focused? To me, it's fairly obvious. We descend from the crazies. We descend from the other thinkers from around the world who said, this isn't good enough for me. I'm going to risk my life crossing oceans and borders in order to get to a place that offers me no security, but offers me freedom. Mm-hmm. We got all the nut jobs who wanted something better. Could Steve Jobs, he's of Syrian descent, could he have started Apple in Damascus? No. In the United States, people who think differently can very often be funded. And so they keep doing amazing things. It's no mistake that our entrepreneurs are known around the world. We descend from the people who took the ultimate entrepreneurial leap. They left what was, in a sense, comfortable, maybe not always, taking in search of just freedom. And so I love the American story. And one of the reasons I'm so for open borders is I want more and more people to come and participate in it.
Well, I love your line about improving individuals economically. And one of the themes that we use in thinking about entrepreneurship is the ethic of entrepreneurship, which might be a bad word to use. It sounds a bit serious, but it's that the purpose of entrepreneurship is to improve other people's lives. And that's a benefit. It rolls up to a better society. And we should think of entrepreneurship as service to others. Is that a useful theme, do you think?
I think it is. I would say maybe term phrase a little bit differently. I would say entrepreneurs lead. They lead us to a better place because let's never forget, to me, the definition of an entrepreneur is someone who's got a vision that everyone else thinks is ridiculous, yet they do it anyway. Is they think the way things are being done now, nah. And so they quite literally lead us to a better place. I've heard it's apocryphal, but Henry Ford's genius was realizing that, you know, horse-drawn carriages weren't enough, so he would give them something different. Steve Jobs looked at the BlackBerry phone and he thought, oh, come on. Yet that's what everyone wanted at the time. He thought, oh, we can improve on that. And let's never forget, he was ridiculed at the time that the iPhone was coming out. Most people thought it'd be a niche product that most people wouldn't buy. I'm fascinated to look at Elon Musk right now. Their new SUV, the design of it came out, and he said something along the same lines that this is something in the future. And that's what Mises said in liberalism. He said, entrepreneurs, every entrepreneurial act is a speculation. You're doing something you're not sure people are going to want. And that's what's so important about entrepreneurs. They take us somewhere else. They don't just meet our needs. They exceed them. They take us to a new place.
Yeah, Jobs had another phrase, which is a real challenge when you think about what it takes to be an entrepreneur. He said, we've got to read what's not on the page. And you know, it hasn't been written down yet. We've got to be able to read it. And that's why I rejected consumer research and that kind of thing. So they lead, but they also imagine things that other people don't imagine. Is that how you see it?
Oh, without question. They are the outside thinkers. That they envision things that only become obvious after the fact. Let's never forget that Silicon Valley is littered with VCs that turned down Facebook, that turned down Amazon. I remember in the year 2000, 2001, if you owned Amazon shares, you were ridiculed. Remember, Amazon was Amazon.org. Mm-hmm. These are people that think so differently and have a vision that is so outside the norm. And it's one reason I don't want to get, I promise I won't take us too much off subject, but I've, one of the people I think who's needlessly facing trouble right now is Elizabeth Holmes. She had a vision for something different and it attracted a lot of attention. And now because it didn't work on time, they're thinking about him. Some people want her imprisoned. Mm-hmm. I want these creative types who want to do something that differently. I want them out creating. Michael Milken decades ago, because he did something so differently and upended the norms of investment banking, they put him in prison. And you think about, what did we lose? Here was the guy who said, MCI is a nothing company. I'm going to find funding for it so that it can take on AT&T, which at the time employed 1 in 500 Americans. And then he saw the future of mobile phones. Mobile phones cost $4,000. No one could afford them. It was seen as just this weird luxury bauble of the rich. And he thought, there's a way to get that funded. How could we live without it? I not only think entrepreneurs are important for taking us to new places, but I elevate investment bankers and the Wall Street types that so many people heap scorn on because they figure out a way to get financing to these brilliant people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So socially, we should be encouraging all of that, that craziness, that imagination, and getting them capital, as you say. Are the barriers purely governmental? You write a lot about barriers and regulation, and the government is taking away our production. I love that term that you use. It makes things very clear. Is that the only barrier in society to the entrepreneurs?
They're broadly governmental. I also think there can be a failure of imagination on the part of people. Let's be clear, it's hard enough. There's a reason investment bankers are paid so well, and they are because it's enormously difficult to attract capital to one's venture. And so it's hard enough for a business, and so investment bankers are paid enormous fees, rightly, for getting capital. Imagine if you're someone who has an idea that totally upends how things have been done in the past. And let's be clear, there's someone out there right now who's going to upend Amazon, probably in our lifetimes. Now, but imagine trying to get funding for that. So there are non-governmental barriers for sure. It's failure to imagine what could be. Entrepreneurs see that. But generally, I think they're governmental.
Yeah, and scarcity of capital, though, you've written, is actually a good thing because it forces the capital to find the best ideas, or forces the best ideas to find the capital. I liked your chapter about Hollywood. All the lights are always red in Hollywood. It's hard to get financing. That's why the movie industry is so great.
Yeah, no, of course, capital is scarce. There's this idea out there, and I think sometimes modern Austrians promote it, that there's such thing as zero interest rates. No, never has, never will be. The idea, capital is always scarce. It always has been, because when you borrow money, per Mises, you're borrowing what money can be exchanged for. You're borrowing access to trucks, tractors, computers, desks, chairs, movie scripts, movie cameras, brilliant directors. And so it's always going to be difficult to get access to these kinds of resources. What I usually say with that in mind, how dangerous is government spending? Because government spending shrinks the availability of what's accessed out there. But I think this is important. I'm so glad you hit on this, because I think too often modern Austrians, once again, I don't think Mises would have ever really fallen for this. And from what I've read of him, and I've read the vast majority of his books, this idea of easy money, I find that so insulting and Keynesian stupid. Easy money? Really? No such thing. Implicit in easy money is that, here, line up 0% rate, 1%, and you can get access to the economy's resources. I've never met an entrepreneur who's ever had an experience like that. I've never met in a business like who's had an experience like that. In Hollywood, that's from my Fed book, credit's incredibly expensive. In Silicon Valley, it's so expensive. If you want to fund a business, you're going to give up a big percentage of it to a to a venture capitalist. Michael Milken got rich precisely because the availability of credit and capital to businesses is exceedingly hard to get. And so he found it for businesses that in past times could never really get it. And so I think our side does so much damage to itself when it talks, oh yeah, you know, the Fed went to zero and money's easy. No such thing. Let's not insult the entrepreneurial function by pretending that the Fed, just by printing dollars or whatever it is Austrians think it does, can make access to resources easy. That's insults the entrepreneur.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you would have enjoyed a recent episode that we had on the fintech industry, the financial technology, I guess it's short for. But the point we made is all of these new emerging online lenders, the Cabbage and the GoFundMe and those kinds of things, are a brilliant way to match capital to entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial projects. And in fact, because there's so much competition there, we're probably approaching on those platforms what Mises would have called the originary interest rate, i.e. the right interest rate for society irrespective of regulation. So actually entrepreneurs, helping entrepreneurs, are getting to the right understanding of interest and the cost of capital.
Yeah, but let's be, I think Mises would agree that the interest rate is different for everyone. And of course it is. If I go into a bank and want to borrow money for a business, there's probably no rate at which they'd lend to me. Jeff Bezos could give away all of his worldly possessions today, and he could walk into banks in any city in the U.S. and walk out with billions. Interest, credit, and Hazlitt was good on this. Credit is what you bring. Or I think J.P. Morgan said that. But the point is that this idea that I think too many Austrians promote that, oh, yeah, well, the Fed went to zero and so suddenly credit was easy, is so divorced from reality. Everyone's got a different rate. And as I keep arguing, based on you talk about fintech, it's just a reminder that the Fed's ability to influence the economy is exponentially more theoretical than real. The Fed projects its influence through a banking system that is so antiquated and so yesterday, it represents what, 10 to 15% of total lending, and it's the least intrepid of lending of all. Most intrepid lending takes place well away from the banking system. And for obvious reasons, there's this view that the Fed is why banks pay so little for deposits. No, the Fed follows banks. Banks pay very little for deposits simply because they're not taking any risks. If they were taking risks, they would pay more. And so you see through these fintech functions, that's where you can get a higher interest rate simply because the capital allocations they're making are more risk focused. Banks are in business to not lose money. Other non-banks are in the business of doing different things. And so the rates they pay for those who put money with them reflect that reality.
Yep, our expert on that show, Dusty Wunderlich, said it's the best priced capital in the market for entrepreneurs because it's.
I believe it because let's not forget an entrepreneur could never go to a bank. And again, I love the Austrian school, but I've never understood the modern focus with the Fed. The Fed deals with banks, which are so unimportant. Does anyone seriously think that banks have anything to do with what happens in Silicon Valley? Banks can't touch innovation. And they can't because, as you and I know, entrepreneurs fail over 90% of the time. Banks have to make loans to entities that are going to pay back. We had entrepreneurs are in the business of experimenting, failing, and trying again. What the Fed and banks do has nothing to do with economic progress or economic growth. So the focus on it has always been a mystery.
Yeah, we're much more focused on the parts of human action that talk about the entrepreneur being the driving force of the market system. And that's the other genius of Mises, is having identified that and described it and understood how it works.
Yep. Without question, entrepreneurs lead. They take the risks to move us forward. And that's why I make such energetic arguments in favor of reduced government spending, reduced taxation, ideally no taxation on capital gains. You want it to make it as easy as possible for those with unspent wealth, arguably being the most crucial people in an economy, to match their unspent wealth with entrepreneurs. And what's important about this is the less we take away their unspent wealth, the more they can be intrepid with it. They can try new things. If I've got $1 billion, I'm going to take a lot of risks. If I've got $1 million, I'm probably not going to take many risks at all. And so when we tax away the wealth of the richest, we tax away the most important wealth of all, that which has the highest odds of being directed toward new ideas that, while they look promising sometimes, have very high odds of failure.
You said in one of your books, I don't have the quote with me, John, but that maybe it was an article, entrepreneurs will always be able to innovate around politicians. And it reminds me of another book that just came out from the Cato Institute called Evasive Entrepreneurs. I'm not sure I like the title, but it was the same sentiment that the entrepreneurs will always be smarter, faster, and more agile than the politicians. What did you have anything specific in mind when you
wrote
that?
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. I love that. Thank you for bringing that up. It was an April 13th column I wrote where I said that despite this disaster, this political disaster that we're enduring, whereby politicians impose command and control, the U.S. economy will roar back. And my point is, and the point I made in it, is you talk to entrepreneurs. This goes back to 2009. I asked a rich entrepreneur in Houston, hey, what's going to happen? Things are looking pretty bleak. And he said, oh, come on. He said, I am way too smart for Obama. And I was way too smart for George W. too. These guys mean nothing to me. I can innovate around them. And I always have. And never forget, with entrepreneurs, they stare death in the face every day. Phil Knight, one of the greatest entrepreneurs who ever lived, spent the first 18 years of Nike's existence kind of gently telling his wife each night, oh no, we're going to make it. And his line in his wonderful memoir, Shoe Dog, was, I was telling her something I didn't necessarily believe. Nike nearly died so many times. Mm-hmm. And that's true. Entrepreneurs, all they know is near death, or they've built a company that died. And so the idea that these clowns in Washington and around the country who just tragically shut down an economy, this is nothing to these guys. They'll innovate around them. It's what they've always done.
Yep. I hear family in the background.
Yes, my 3.5-year-old who, even at this stage, is constantly being spoken to by me about the importance of entrepreneurialism and a lack of.
Good. Start them young. That's the right idea.
That's right.
I'm just about to ask John Tamney about his own entrepreneurial journey. It's a very distinctive one. He's worked for many great companies, and inside those companies, he's created some new businesses. He's run them himself, or he's passed them on to the corporation. In addition, he's created for himself a very distinctive writing style, and that creation has given great propulsion to his writing career. Are you considering an entrepreneurial journey? If you are, a good place to start is our online Austrian Entrepreneurial Journey course. You can find it at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number 4, letter E, pod.com/journey. And now let's hear about John's entrepreneurial journey.
So let me flip the switch there and talk about your entrepreneurial journey, John. I read chapter 7 in The End of Work, which you could say your path was uncharted. It meandered a little bit. You talk about some painful experiences like downsizing that you lived your way through, but you found your way to success doing something that you love. You said it elevates your spirit. You're obviously brilliant at it. We use the journey metaphor, the entrepreneurial journey. Is that a good way to think about it from your experience?
I would. Thank you very much. I'm so flattered you read that chapter. I had such high hopes and still have high hopes for The End of Work. I think the one of the most unsung, brilliant, beautiful aspects of economic growth is that it frees more and more people to specialize and do something that they can't get enough of, that doesn't feel like work, but that pays them, mm-hmm. because work for their work. And certainly, I will never put myself in the, I can't claim that what I did was Phil Knight-esque or Jeff Bezos-esque. I've always been employed by someone else. I never had the courage really to go fully out on my own, but I have had lots of failure. I was laid off by Goldman Sachs during a big market downturn in 2001. It was devastating. It didn't make it into the book. It was supposed to, because I put it into it and it didn't make it into the edits, but I was demoted at Forbes back in 2014. I'd been opinions editor and got on the wrong side of some people. And so I was pushed out of that job, and it was just ripped my heart out. And so, but each time it forced me to get better at what I did. I've been kicked down, nothing like what Phil Knight did or what some of these other great entrepreneurs, but I've been kicked around too. And it does make you better. It's agonizing, but thank goodness we live in, and we get to operate in an economy where, yes, precisely because they can fire you and demote you, there's also lots of opportunities to get to dust yourself off, as it were, and get back to work. And so I'd like to think I keep learning from what I've done wrong. And I can't believe how lucky I am to get to write about economics. I just every day, and that's probably why I write so much. Not only do I have so much to say, but I feel like I've been given the ultimate opportunity to people pay me to write what's on my mind. You better believe I'm not going to skip a day then if they're going to give me such an opportunity.
Well, you've created some businesses inside other companies, or you created or helped to create Real Clear Markets inside the Forbes empire. So there's entrepreneurship can occur inside big companies. In fact, it's important for it to occur inside big companies. So you've been an entrepreneur of great fame, I think.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you've also done something else, which I think of as entrepreneurial, is you've created a very distinctive style in your writing. I was trying to find some adjectives that would help me describe it. And it's kind of contrarian. You're saying to people, hey, get real, when you talk about the Fed, for example, and so on. We've also got stylistic individuality with some of your sentence structures and the way you use words. So how did you develop a distinctive style and become good at writing? It seems like a pretty hard thing to do.
Thank you. Some would say, and I would agree with them, I've got an angry writing style. I think sometimes people think I write things funny, but I don't think I'm a particularly funny writer. Some people have that skill. Probably the most distinctive quality to my writing is I've got a major chip on my shoulder. I won't hide from it. I came into this field via fundraising, as you know from my book, Think Tank, that didn't think I was worthy of being a scholar there. And so I'm not only contrarian, I must admit there's a part of me that wants to prove the people wrong who never took me seriously. Mm-hmm. So yes, I'm contrarian as can be, because I think the generalized assumptions made by both sides are frequently incorrect, but there's also probably within me, there's a lot of, I'll show you, all you people, all the people who wouldn't give me a chance to write, who wouldn't take me seriously. Oh, I'm going to show you.
Yeah, and that seems to me like a perfectly valid motivation, and you know, within other motivations. One of the things we get mad at to follow in your footsteps there is entrepreneur bashing. I mean, at the high level, it's Bezos, and how can anybody be so rich, despite the fact that he's provided great service to a fantastic number of people all over the world. But even generally, the pursuit of profit is the devil. And we get mad about that. So we're trying to be contrarian about that attitude that seems to be out there in society.
Yeah, it's a great question. I always say to people, if Jeff Bezos had reached the top of his game in 1970, he would have been the richest man in America, maybe the world. And so what would his net worth have been? What, 500 million, a billion? I mean, I don't know what was richest back then, but not much more than a billion. And so to that, I say, what a tragedy. that someone so talented could reach so few people in a relative sense. And so nowadays he's worth, what, $150 billion, and that's after the divorce. And the reason he is because he's touching exponentially more people with his genius around the world. Thanks to technological advances, Jeff Bezos in Seattle, it can be as though he's operating next door to people around the world. And so to me, the greater the inequality, the greater the progress, because it's just a sign that the individuals that you and I elevate are able to attach themselves to capital on the way to meeting the needs of people in ways that past entrepreneurs weren't able to come close to. And so I think this needs to be discussed over and over again. I think so often free market types punt the inequality thing. Well, they say, actually, if you look at the Gini coefficient, they revert to their graphs and charts and their numbers. We're not that unequal. Oh, no, we're very unequal. And in fact, we free market types, if we get our way, low taxes, limited zero out all the regulations, stable money, all those things, inequality is going to soar and it will be a beautiful thing. And why we run from that, why we run from the process whereby brilliant minds innovate for us and transform our living conditions for the better on the way to becoming really rich, why that's perceived as a bad thing is a mystery to me. And again, I want to stress so much of what I say goes back to things I've learned from von Mises. What did he say? Luxury is an historical concept. Mm-hmm. So much of this was obvious to him long ago, that what the rich enjoy is just a preview of what we'll all enjoy if the economy remains free, because what the rich enjoy, they establish as venture buyers. They buy something that's beyond the reach of everyone. They establish a market use for it, at which point entrepreneurs mass produce it. And I just think for too long, our sides run away from this. Inequality is a wonderful thing. The tragedy is when inequality is not increasing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, another phrase from Mises is that entrepreneurs are the people who allocate capital to best serve the most urgent needs of consumers. And they should be viewed as heroes for that.
As heroes, and let's also, I've used this quote from him in at least two of my books, maybe three. He always said that when a business goes out of business, it can no longer bring damage in many instances to mm-hmm. customers, but much more articulately than I have just now. But we seem to, Americans, as much as they venerate the entrepreneur, there's this need within people to say, well, you know, the small business, oh my gosh, isn't that noble and great and everything? No, I think the big businesses are most noble. They meet the needs most. Now, do all businesses start small? Yeah, that's a given. But there's this view out there that somehow that inequality is bad. No, inequality is good. It's when people aren't becoming unequal that they're probably not meeting the needs of very many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, you wrote that the best way to help entrepreneurs in small business is to unleash the big businesses, because often the big businesses are the customers and they also generate the economic ripples that the entrepreneurs can feed on.
Yeah, to be clear, there are generally no small businesses without big businesses. Mm-hmm. Any shopping mall, is it any mystery why there are anchor tenants? Well, yeah, the anchor tenants, the big businesses, the big global brands are what attract people to them on the way to creating a market for the small businesses that climb on them. There's this, again, conservatives get all Main Street on us on occasionally in weird ways, and they say, well, small businesses create all the jobs. Even if you believe that, even if you believe job creation is the purpose of a business, they're able to create jobs precisely because, for the most part, they cluster around big businesses. And so this need within society to ennoble the small, to ennoble the average, I find very odd. I think I like the big ones, that they make the small entrepreneurs possible.
Yeah. Well, let's pick your brain as our chief marketing officer, John. We both know what what movement we're trying to start, the pro-economics, pro-entrepreneurship, pro-innovation. We want everybody to think like that. We want everybody to be an entrepreneur of sorts, whether it's working for a big corporation or a small corporation. We want to have them do that as opposed to be bureaucrats. If you were the chief marketing officer for that movement, where would you start tomorrow?
I would start with happy things. Mm-hmm. I've never understood why some in the conservative libertarian movement, they begin with, well, if we don't cut spending, we're going to be the Titanic hitting the iceberg. And if we don't do this, if we don't get those deficits under control, this is going to happen. And Americans aren't, the birth rate's not high enough. Talk about the good things. My problem with government spending isn't deficits. I don't care about deficits. I mean, let's ask ourselves the basic question. Next 10 years, which scenario is better? $50 trillion in total government spending, federal spending, where all of it's in quote balance, or $25 trillion in total federal spending, where half of it's borrowed? I'll take the deficit scenario any day of the week. The problem is all the money being spent by politicians. Is every dollar that gets to Congress, it means that it's an extra dollar of control that Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer and Kevin McCarthy and Barack Obama and Donald Trump have over the economy. So the focus should just be on limiting how much they spend. Don't worry about how they get it, limiting how much they spend. And the idea with that is every dollar that remains in the private sector has better odds of finding entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. Less government spending, more Jeff Bezos, more Steve Jobs, because these guys are the oddballs. And so we have to ask the question, we ask it positively, how many great entrepreneurial concepts that will give us, make private flight accessible for all, that will make innovations in transportation that make flight seem yesteryear, how many will we miss out on if government consumes so much of the precious resources always and everywhere created in the private sector? And so I think the focus should always be, do you love Amazon? Do you love your Apple iPhone? Do you like your Nike shoes? Yes, we all do. And so wouldn't we like multiples of Steve Jobs, multiples of Jeff Bezos? Yes, I think we all would. Imagine our living standards. Well, the only way to get to that point is to match more and more talented, striving people with capital. Okay, the only way to get to that is to shrink the burden of government, shrink the taxation, all those things that limit the ability of wealth producers to direct their wealth to future wealth creators.
Good. Well, happy is a good metaphor or a good theme for our marketing of economics. So, John, I wanted to thank you for joining us today, and I wanted to thank you for your immense productivity in getting this happy message out. You're incredibly high output when you look at all the articles and the books and the podcasts and the webinars and so on like that you've been involved in. So we thank you very much for who you are.
Well, thank you, Hunter, so much for having me on. Honestly, it was so flattering to get an email from you. It's a great show. How lucky am I to have people who actually are interested in what I have to say? I've been thrilled to come on, and again, I just feel really lucky to be able to do what I do. And so it's there's immense joy in what I do, and that's, if I can leave it there, as I argue in The End of Work, my third book, the greatest gift of economic growth is freedom from work we despise. I'm so lucky to do what I do. I couldn't not do it. It would cost a lot of money to get me to not do it because I enjoy it so much. And maybe this is the greatest argument for the things we believe. Again, freedom from work we hate. And so I'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Yes, please.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's MISES.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.